From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Today on the program, a set of ancient footprints are prompting archaeologists to question past thinking about when humans arrived in North America. Later this hour, we'll talk with a pair of geologists who've been doing the work on what's being called a landmark discovery. But first, as we go to air Thursday morning, it's been 1 year, 6 months, and 19 days since the WHO declared COVID-19 a global pandemic. Especially in those early days, for those of us who could keep doing our jobs from home, it felt like a privilege, especially as we saw so many of our fellow Americans furloughed, laid off, or outright fired. But now, closing on 19 months later, some are finding that work-from-home routine to be harder than ever.
Some are calling it the employee burnout epidemic. A new survey by Watson Towers Willis, exclusive to CNBC, found that 87% of employers said that stress and burnout are issues for their workforce.
From service workers to corporate America, the highs and lows over the last 18 months have millions of Americans saying they're just burnt out.
Women continue to bear the emotional and economic brunt of the crisis. According to a survey from the Kaiser Family Foundation, more than half of all women reported their mental health has suffered over the past 16 months.
Burnout. It goes beyond just feeling overwhelmed or tired, and it can bring with it a number of mental and physical symptoms. And it's more likely to affect women and people of color. Women in the Workplace, the largest study on the state of women in corporate America, found that the gap in experiencing burnout between women and men has nearly doubled over the past year. Many companies are making a point of addressing these issues, and yet one in three women say they've considered either downshifting their careers or leaving the workforce entirely. And for women of color who can experience added layers of discrimination, this feeling is that much heavier. And all this can be fairly easy to overlook or misunderstand, especially when we're interacting with colleagues through the lens of a webcam. Joining us now to talk more about workplace burnout and its disproportionate effects is Teresa Mock. She's a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana. Teresa, welcome back to The 21st.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jennifer Moss. She's a contributor to the Harvard Business Review, a radio columnist, and the author of The Burnout Epidemic, The Rise of Chronic Stress and How We Can Fix It. Jennifer, welcome to The 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Listeners, in order to make schedules meet for this conversation, we're taping ahead of time, so we're not taking calls this hour, but we do always appreciate hearing what you thought about what we discussed, so do get in touch. You can find all the ways to do so through our website, 21stshow.org. All right, Jennifer, I want to begin with you, and can we start with sort of a definition of burnout in the workplace? What are some of the key things to look for to indicate that one of your colleagues might be experiencing this?
Well, you mentioned the WHO announcement and just what they defined as the pandemic in March of 2020. Well, they were already defining burnout as a major issue in 2019 when they included it into their International Classification of Diseases, IDC 11. They identified it as a syndrome, not necessarily a disease. But what they did say is that it is defined as an occupational phenomenon, so workplace stress left unmanaged. And that was really important for people in the space that I'm in that are trying to get more accountability at the organizational level. And they see this coming up with three big signs that you are burning out. And that could mean levels of exhaustion. So how exhausted you're feeling throughout the week, how often you are feeling disengaged or mentally distanced from one's work. And then the third piece is that level of cynicism. So how much control or lack of control do you feel about the outcomes of your work? So all of that together is actually contributing to, I think, a more fulsome version and definition of burnout.
So, Teresa, if you have a mental health issue, not a mental illness, where does a person begin when they're feeling burned out? Is this something people commonly seek therapy or medical treatment for?
Yeah, I think they often do. I think sometimes the first step is even to recognize that you're feeling this way. Like Jennifer talked about, feeling exhausted or disengaged, maybe noticing feeling sort of more cynical towards work, and that sort of prioritizing yourself, saying you need to take care of yourself. And it can help to make a really conscious choice to prioritize self-care and assess what you can do to change. You can do that by yourself or with other people. Lots of people seek therapy for it to sort of develop a plan. So oftentimes people do identify burnout, but they also identify some of the feelings associated with it as well. Depression, anxiety, and feeling overwhelmed.
We asked members of our texting group, Text the 21st, about whether they have been feeling burned out and working from home in the last year or the last year and a half, I should say. Let's take a listen to one of the voicemails we got from a listener.
Hello, this is Joe from Urbana. I mean, the pandemic has been something else. I mean, I think staying at home and working from home and having everybody there, relationships have been frayed at home, and relationships at work were non-existent. You were online and you were on a flat screen, and that's very difficult looking at yourself and looking at other people very closely. So the stress and burnout is real. I mean, the burnout from personal relationships and the burnout from work relationships, frayed relationships at home, frayed relationships at work, have a great recipe for burnout. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
All right. So thank you for that message, Joe. Teresa, I wonder if you have a reaction to what he had to say there.
Yeah, I think he's echoing what a lot of people feel, that a lot of social relations are fraying or more difficult. It's hard to connect with people, although there's this paradox of also feeling connected 24/7, that phones, computers have made that possible. And I think it can be exhausting. People talk about feeling like they're working from home. It contributes to longer work days. I think people are often having difficulty separating work from their personal life. And I think broadly speaking, sometimes working 24/7, working really hard, not needing much sleep, sometimes is glamorized, even though naturally it can lead to exhaustion. And I think research has shown that lots of employees feel like they need to be available around the clock and to work long hours just to advance, which is really unhealthy.
Yeah, there's that American hustle culture, right? Rise and grind, mm-hmm. that kind of thing. You know, Jennifer, some people like the comfort of being able to work from home. Others, maybe not so much. I guess maybe that depends in large part on whether you have children in the house, how much space you have to dedicate to work. And it can be difficult to convey that tiredness or burnout and step away from the screen. Can you talk about how work from home is changing the trajectory, maybe of what workplaces are expecting from their people? And is it a factor that's contributing to burnout? Or, I mean, could there be a way where it could ease it?
Well, it's interesting because what we found is during the pandemic that there was a real impact, and you mentioned this earlier, on women because of unpaid labor. We saw that number of unpaid labor hours increase to 15 to 20 hours extra per week, which is really sent women out of the workforce, and that's a problem. But what we're finding now, actually, and we did some research in between the third and the fourth wave of the pandemic, that it's actually our younger generation that are feeling the loneliness component really impact their desire to go back into an office space. So we want to have flexibility, but a lot of our younger professionals are feeling like, and what we kept seeing from the themes of the data is they're saying, I'm not being seen. I feel like my career is being held back. I don't have a reputation yet. So I have to sort of identify myself as a high performer. I miss being with people because I live alone. So we're seeing this flip now once kids have gone back to school, that it's more, you know, women that do want to have that remote capacity. They like being at home. And it's our younger generation of workers that want to go back and be with other people and develop and reestablish relationships at work.
Let me take a moment to remind listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about working from home and burnout now that we're closing in on 19 months of the pandemic, at least for those of us who have been able to keep working from home. Obviously, there's a lot of frontline workers from grocery stores to hospitals who have had to be at work pretty much the entire pandemic, have not had the opportunity to work from home. But we're talking about this with Teresa Mock, who's a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana, and Jennifer Moss, a contributor to the Harvard Business Review, author of The Burnout Epidemic, The Rise of Chronic Stress and How We Can Fix It. We'd love to hear what you thought about our conversation. We're not taking calls because we recorded this ahead of time, but you can always tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21ST Show. Teresa, there are a lot of products out there being marketed at people in the name of self-care, sort of trying to capitalize on the stress people are feeling right now. You have everything from beauty products to oil diffusers to special yoga and workout routines. Can you talk about what it actually means to practice self-care and whether it's you know, something people can buy?
Absolutely. And I think that's a really great point. And we need to consider sort of the broader cultural context in which self-care products are marketed. There's a really heavy focus on purchasing products, on getting an app for self-care. And I think even the language we use, there's even a sense there's a sort of right way to do self-care. When I think the reality is that self-care can be hard, and sometimes it can be boring. And while it can vary a lot from person to person, there might be some common areas that people would benefit from considering. And what I mean by that is self-care can look like getting enough sleep, eating the right food, engaging in physical activity. And those things may be difficult. They may not be glamorous. Self-care can also look like setting boundaries with other people. It can look like saying no to things you don't want to do or don't want to take on, and it can risk displeasing other people. And those things can be really hard sometimes. I think especially sometimes for women who are encouraged to sort of take on a lot, as we know. So none of those things that I think really speak to self-care can be purchased, and it can be hard work to kind of think about how you'd like your life to look and what you can do to achieve this beyond products.
We got a text message from one of our listeners in Central Illinois who says, "I am so burned out from the dual pressures of COVID and the general financial problems affecting higher education that I'm seriously considering retiring several years early, even if it means a cut in pay. I do not feel well supported by the administration, as the faculty and staff's real income has been dropping year after year of no raises and even a cut to our benefits," this person said. Jennifer, we have seen some major companies like LinkedIn giving its workers a paid week off. Some companies are doing Zoom-free Fridays, allowing their staff more leeway when structuring their workday. Some of this requires employees to make their own calls about how and when they work. In your book, you talk about how companies can build an anti-burnout strategy based on prevention and not just perks. Can you talk about, are these, you know, things that I've been listing out there, are these real solutions to burnout?
So I really appreciate what Teresa just said about the idea that, you know, sometimes it is hard and it might not look like, you know, as sexy as being able to have the silver bullet solution where we can pay for, you know, this remedy to burnout. One of the things that I've come to identify is that, you know, a lot of organizations, you know, really like to have this resolution, and they are mixing up well-being strategies with burnout prevention strategies. One is really downstream, and that helps us to motivate and optimize. That's the apps and some of those other programs that help us to, you know, get to a point where if we're doing okay, that we can then do a bit better. What we're really needing to do is look at, instead of giving a week off for our burned out employees, we need to stop burning them out in the first place. So that's upstream interventions. That means dealing with unmanageable workload. It's, you know, making sure that people aren't feeling like they're not being rewarded and valued for their time. This means looking at the root causes of burnout, which is way, way further downstream. And that's where Teresa talks about that self-care piece. I mean, it's the fundamentals. It's the hygiene of our life right now that's missing inside of organizations. And you can't really, you know, give someone ice cream when what they need is water. And that I think is where the delta is right now.
Interesting. I like that metaphor. You can't give them ice cream when what they need is water. All right. We have to take a break here. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Jennifer Moss, who's the author of The Burnout Epidemic, The Rise of Chronic Stress and How We Can Fix It. Also, Teresa Mock, who's a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana. We're talking about burnout, especially in the workplace, people who are working from home, going on 19 months now in this pandemic, and how they're reacting to it. We're not taking calls because we had to tape this conversation early, but you can always Let us know what you thought by tweeting at us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. And you can also join our texting group, Text the 21st. You do that by sending the word talk to 217-803-0730. And then sometimes when we cannot take calls during the show, we do seek out what listeners are thinking still that way. And you can weigh in like Katie did for this segment. She said, "No burnout from work. I'm used to working remote. The burnout is managing kids and family and working at the same time." And coming up after the break, we're going to talk about the particular burden that women have faced during the pandemic and how that is leading to increased feelings of burnout. This is measurable. This is quantified among women more so than men. That's going to come up after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with Teresa Mock, who's a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana, and Jennifer Moss, who's the author of The Burnout Epidemic, The Rise of Chronic Stress and How We Can Fix It. The pandemic has been with us for going on 19 months now. For those of us who've been fortunate enough to be able to work from home, that is getting to be a grind for some people, at least. Communicating with colleagues through screens rather than in person, it takes its toll, and we're seeing a rise in burnout. And this, we know, has also been borne disproportionately by women, women of color, who in many cases have the added layer of not only dealing with work from the workplace, but work in the home life. Students who have been on virtual education, and even now, though many students are back in school this year, there are still quarantines popping up because of positive exposures and things like that. So this is something that there's really no end in sight yet as to when the situation might return to something like our pre-pandemic normal. So let's, Jennifer, let's talk about now, we've been talking about employees, but what about employers and supervisors, bosses, who might also be experiencing burnout themselves? How can someone who's, you know, typically seen as a leader, signal to others in the workplace that they too are maybe burning out?
You know, that's a really important question. I've been doing this talk, Exhausted Leaders Leading Exhausted Teams, and I think that says it all. We are going through this trauma collectively, and even if people are coping okay and seem to be doing well inside of this pandemic, there's a level of guilt, and they also feel just, you know, the byproduct of this experience is weighing on them. So everyone has gone through this, and whether you're a leader or an employee or a senior executive, you've been dealing with grief and loss of tradition and loss of your old life. And one of the things that we've continued to see work inside of organizations, and I found this through anecdotal, you know, research and conversations and also through data, is that when leaders get to a point where they remove the stoicism and they understand that this is a point where we need to create some parity, they let down their guard and there's some vulnerability. And every time I talk to a leader that said, "I just decided to let my team know what was going on with me," it changed the dynamic. And that is what I really want to encourage, even in those organizations where that is maybe there's a fear of stigma around behaving that way. What I continue to see over and over again is whenever there's a level of vulnerability within these leadership groups, that it actually engages the team in a much more healthy way.
You know, Teresa, I wonder if you have a perspective on that. Leaders who are experiencing burnout, maybe not all of them are willing to be vulnerable in front of their team, as Jennifer has suggested there. What would you say to them?
I think I'd echo what Jennifer said. Showing vulnerability doesn't have to be seen as a weakness, and perhaps that's a bigger societal issue to kind of grapple with, but that it really can be humanizing. I think for employees to see this idea of other people are struggling, it's not just me, in ways they can feel, end up feeling sort of empowering and making people feel more connected, which is, I think, speaks to the disconnect that people are feeling with this pandemic.
Now, Teresa, I also wanted to ask you, I mentioned earlier, and I think it's well documented now at this point in the pandemic, and maybe the pandemic has sort of highlighted this, but burnout is not something that's experienced equally among demographics. Can you talk about how closely it's tied to things like class and race?
Mm-hmm. So when we think about sort of a stereotypical image of a person practicing self-care, I think it often is a white woman taking what we hear of as me time, maybe reclining in a bubble bath, eating chocolates or ice cream and drinking wine. So there's a real sense of taking time for yourself. And I think people are told that, take time for yourself, take time to take care of yourself. But the implication is take time for yourself and then get back to work. So clearly that kind of message is marketed to upper class people who have the income and time to engage in those kinds of activities, who can afford to take a break. But it also lays responsibility for being burned out, I think, on the individual. It suggests if you're burned out, you just haven't prioritized yourself, or you just haven't taken time to take care of yourself, rather than examine the societal forces that in lots of ways, I think, encourage people to work until they're exhausted.
You know, Jennifer, something I think I hear Teresa saying there is like, well, you haven't taken time to care for yourself, that self-care, as it were, becomes yet another thing that people feel pressure like, oh, I'm not doing that good enough either, right? Oh, I'm not meditating. I'm not going for a bike ride. I'm not taking that bubble bath with a glass of wine or whatever. Can you talk about sort of turning self-care into yet another thing on which people can feel inadequate?
Absolutely. It's probably been one of my biggest frustrations over the years is hearing, you know, suggestions to deal with burnout is just saying no, which is essentially, you know, blaming the victim for their own abuse. If you look at how privileged that is, asking a single parent who this is their sole income to say that they're going to go to their boss and just demand that they're not going to work as much is really unfair, or people that are dealing, you know, with systemic discrimination inside of their organizations. There's no way that they can be asked to just say no to work. And we keep being told that the burnout, that, you know, that burnout is on us to solve. And I've been really trying to create more conversation around the accountability that has to happen around an ecosystem approach to solving for it. Organizations, you know, might not be responsible for your happiness, but they're also not, you know, they have to be responsible for not making you sick. And so we need to put these two things together where we need to be thinking about our own happiness and psychological fitness as fundamental to who we want to be and how we want to live, but also that organizations need to play a role in making sure that they support that so that all of that effort is not in vain.
Jennifer, I also wanted to ask you about, we talked a little earlier about some of the demographic disparities in these feelings of burnout, but there's also this role of gender and women in the workplace. And we know that more women than men experience the, I would say, burden or responsibility of family care. We've seen that a lot during the pandemic. Most children are back in school, at least in Illinois, full-time this year, but there are still increased childcare needs, right? If a school or daycare needs to close because of a coronavirus outbreak, how do we address burnout in working women, working moms in particular?
This is a big point of interest in an area that I've been, you know, focusing on lately, because I just, as a woman mother myself who has three children, and, you know, I live in a equitable partnership, but what tends to happen is that just women take end up taking on that responsibility unfairly and disproportionately. And I think that that's happened across the entire globe this year. We're looking at 15 to 20 more hours of unpaid labor this year. And women are leaving the workforce. Around 3 million in the US have left. And we're looking about half of them maybe not returning. And so what employers really need to do is start looking at, how are we going to solve for this? We need to be starting right at the beginning with equitable maternity and paternity leaves, making sure that there's policy at the government level around paid family leave. We need to make sure that we are providing the right kind of care and support for child services that are, you know, outside the home. We need to have a whole kind of paradigm shifting way of thinking about equity and understanding that, this was obviously a very big problem pre-pandemic, and it took the pandemic to really highlight the issue. And that's why it's blowing up right now. And it's going to cost in about 20 years, the GDP about $1 trillion if we don't fix this for women right now and inside of our organizations.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce my guests. If you're just joining us, this is the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with Jennifer Moss, who's the author of The Burnout Epidemic and a contributor to the Harvard Business Review, and also Teresa Mock, who's a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana. We're talking about burnout in the workplace, especially as it's experienced among women and people of color. It's pretty widespread. Managers, employees, a lot of people are reporting feeling burned out as we are at more than 18 months into the COVID-19 pandemic. Teresa, the topic of health can be taboo in communities of color and compounded by the stress of systemic racism. I wonder, as a psychologist, what can be done to sort of destigmatize mental health and feelings of burnout in the workplace?
Well, and I think it's something sort of to echo back what I was saying, what Jennifer was saying. We need to really recognize and emphasize this is a systemic issue and not place so much on the individual, because then I think people feel inadequate, they feel shame that they're not doing enough somehow. So workplaces, I think, need to acknowledge and talk clearly about burnout or racism. How are they as an organization trying to address these issues and prevent it, and what remedies are both at an individual level and an organizational level. And I think continued conversations like this can help destigmatize the mental health issues or aspects of it.
Jennifer, for a lot of people, the pressure of being back in the office, going back to work, we're seeing more workplaces have people come back into the office, at least part-time, if not full-time, that can bring its own stresses. Do you have any suggestions for how people might manage their stress levels when they are making the sort of big return to the office?
We've definitely seen the results of 20 months of really shrinking our circles and people getting comfortable being in their own space. There's an increased amount of social anxiety about returning to work, and it's fair. I mean, you have been talking to people virtually, some of these people that you haven't met. I talked about millennials and Gen Zs coming into a workplace where they've never, ever met their boss or their, you know, their teams. And so one of the suggestions that I've been giving to people is, let's figure out ways to, you know, to get comfortable before we have to have this, you know, quote unquote, return to work. We have to be able to feel comfortable enough that we're not sort of terrified of being back in a larger group. And that might mean meeting with people in a smaller group, maybe meeting with one of the people that you feel a more of an allyship with. What we found in what Gallup Q12, why it asked, do you have a best friend at work, is because it actually really is meaningful. When we have a friend at work, it reduces burnout by 41%. So if we can really start to narrow in on a depth of relationship versus breadth of relationships before people go back into those environments where there's a lot of people, I think that's probably a good, slow, nuanced way of approaching returning to work.
You know, yeah, you mentioned younger people newer to the workforce who are have not been in person. Erica Scalise, who's one of our producers on this show, been working on this very conversation we're having now. I've not actually met her yet, only via Zoom screens. Teresa, for especially people closer to the beginning of their career, right? Recent graduates, people who have maybe only known the Zoom office and as opposed to an in-person office, how does that affect them from a mental health standpoint?
Well, I think it can contribute to that sense of knowing people, but not really knowing them. And I think when everything is on Zoom screens like this, what people are missing are some of the informal, by the water cooler moments of just chatting. All of that is gone. And I think people miss that. I think a lot, again, like Jennifer was talking about, a lot of younger workers, or I see people who say they're just starting their careers and they feel very disconnected from their workplace because they don't know anyone beyond what they see for their meetings on their screens. So they feel a lot of isolation. It's hard to know how they can advance in a job or if they even like the career, or they don't know their coworkers. So I think it can contribute to a lot of feelings of isolation and anxiety and depression.
Yeah, I've got to say the onboarding process, even for us here on the show, has probably not been the best that it could be. You know, Jennifer, we're coming to the end of our conversation now, but I wanted to ask, we're seeing especially a lot of younger millennials, Gen Zers, people who are, as we've been talking about, newer to the workforce, getting on social media, and you see their disdain move from individual employers to sort of the capitalist system in general, right? And they say it's failing people, generating chronic stress and racism and anxiety. Do you see a sort of long-term political consequences for this great shift to work from home that we've been doing for a year and a half now?
I do see that there is a paradigm shift that's happening right now. And, you know, sometimes it does take a bottom line reason to make change. And because we are seeing people leave their jobs and demanding more, as a workplace expert and wellness expert, I have to say, this is not a bad thing that the pendulum swung really far in one direction and has come back sort of in the middle, because we've been long advocating for flexibility and more conversations around mental health and less stigma inside of these conversations within the workplaces. And so, you know, sometimes we have to really go far in one direction to kind of right the ship. And I think that's going to be a change. I keep saying it's this taxi Uber moment for workforces, you know, the ones that say, let's go right back to how we were. And, you know, let's go, you know, jam the toothpaste back in the tube. They're going to be obsolete. And the ones that actually understand that we are in a movement, we're in a revolution around mental health at work, and it's led by employees, they have more control now, that it's going to effectively change the future of work for the better.
Jennifer Moss is the author of The Burnout Epidemic, The Rise of Chronic Stress and How We Can Fix It. We've also been speaking with Teresa Mock, a licensed clinical psychologist based in Urbana. Jennifer, Teresa, thank you so much for being with us and talking about this important issue today on the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
Yes, thanks for having us.
Coming up after a short break, we're going to be talking about some new research into sets of footprints that have been found that are prompting archaeologists to say humans were wandering around North America perhaps 10,000 years earlier than previously thought. That conversation after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us.